Amahangstang yadi sajjate grihe. Tada mahatvam vayasa dampatinam. Tada mahatvam vayasa dampatinam. Tada mahatvam vayasa dampatinam. Harir hishakshad bhagavan sharirinam. Atma jashanam ivatoyam ipsitam. Hitva mahangstam yadi sajjate grihe. Tada mahatvam vayasadam patinam. Harir hi sakshad bhagavan sharirinam. Atma jashanam ivatoyam ipsitam. Hitva mahangstam yadi sajjate grihe. Tada mahatvam vayasadam patinam. Hari,
the Lord. He, certainly, Sakshad, directly, Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sharirinam, of all living entities who have accepted material bodies, Atma, the life and soul, Jashanam, of the aquatics, Eva, like, Toyam, the vast water, Ipsitam, is desired, Hitva, giving up, Mahan, a great personality, Tam, him, Yadi, if, Sajjate, becomes attached, Grihe, to household life. Tada, at that time, Mahatvam, greatness, Vayasa, by age, Dampatinam, of the husband and wife. Translation. Just as aquatics always desire to remain in the vast mass of water, all conditioned living entities naturally desire to remain in the vast existence of the Supreme Lord. Therefore, if someone, very great by material calculations, fails to take shelter of the Supreme Soul, but instead becomes attached to material household life, his greatness is like that of a young, low-class couple. One who is too attached to material life loses all good spiritual qualities. Please repeat. Just as aquatics always desire to remain in the vast mass of water, all conditioned living entities naturally desire to remain in the vast existence of the Supreme Lord. Therefore, if someone very great, my material calculations, fails to take shelter of the Supreme Soul, but instead becomes attached to material household life, his greatness is like that of a young, low-class couple. One who is too attached to material life loses all good spiritual qualities. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Jai. Although crocodiles are very fierce animals, they are powerless when they venture out of the water onto land. When they are out of the water, they cannot exhibit their original power. Similarly, the all-pervading Supersoul, Paramatma, is the source of all living entities, and all living entities are part and parcel of Him. When the living entity remains in contact with the all-pervading Vasudeva, the personality of Godhead, he manifests his spiritual power, exactly as the crocodile exhibits its strength in the water. In other words, the greatness of the living entity can be perceived when he is in the spiritual world, engaged in spiritual activities. Many householders, although well educated in the knowledge of the Vedas, become attached to family life. They are compared herein to crocodiles out of water, for they are devoid of all spiritual strength. Their greatness is like that of a young husband and wife who, though uneducated, praise one another and become attracted to their own temporary beauty. This kind of greatness is appreciated only by low-class men with no qualifications. Everyone should therefore seek the shelter of the Supreme Soul, the source of all living entities. No one should waste his time in the so-called happiness of materialistic household life. In the Vedic civilization, this type of crippled life is allowed only until one's 50th year, when one must give up family life and enter either the order of Vanaprastha, independent retired life, for cultivation of spiritual knowledge, or sannyas, the renounced order, in which one completely takes shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Oma jnana, timirandasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshura militam jena tasmai shri gurave namaha. Srila Prabhupada, whose words are our life and soul, even though we may struggle to accept them. Ki jai. Now, were these verses and purports particularly chosen because you knew I was coming? Is this like, you know, the Kauravas who invited Krishna and they gave him a nice big seat to sit on, but then there was a trap door under the seat and Krishna went through the trap door? It was a trick. It looked like a nice big seat. Let's give him a nice big seat, but because he's come from the Pandavas, it'll be a trick. Yeah? Let's invite Kripa Maya to come to Radhadesh, give him a nice big, big throne to sit on, and then give him a can't get out of this purport. Because we know he's over 50, and he's not a sannyasi or a vanaprastha. Let's watch him squirm on the Vyasasan. Is this a plot, Hridai? Huh? That's a nice coincidence. Well, it may be nice for you sitting there. Now, we pray to the Vaishnavas that they are an ocean of compassion. And my name is Kripa Maya. I'm a servant of one who was very kind. But I see that in this purport, my spiritual master is being very cruel. He's being very cruel. Age 50, one should leave one's home and go to the forest. Vanaprastha, one should take sannyas, absolute requirement for everyone in the educated Vedic culture. How is that possible? So I look at this purport and I think, oh, my spiritual master is being very cruel. Yesterday I was explaining to the young students different ways in which we can support each other spiritually as a community through liturgy, ritual, ceremonies, and festivals. And I talked a little bit about funerals. Even funerals bring devotees together and we can reflect on special qualities that will help us in our spiritual life. So in a funeral, I often tell the story. There's two stories I tell at funerals, and no matter where I tell them, devotees always seem to be they always seem to nod their heads and go, yes, like that. And each stage of our life, actually, each transition in our life is a bit of a funeral. Prabhupada said that you go upwards in spiritual life rather like a snake loses its skin. Snake doesn't die, but it loses its old skin. And the old skin has to come off the snake by the snake rubbing up against stones. When the snake rubs up against stones, there's a danger that the nice, smooth snake may get hurt. Jai Vasudeva, jai, jai, jai. So, but this is the only way. If the snake does not lose its old skin, it will choke. It will choke. The snake has to do this rubbing up against the stones. So in the same way, each stage of our devotee life, where we're meant to make a transition to the next stage, there's some rubbing, there's some difficulty. And there may be a little discomfort for a while. But then one finds oneself in a new skin. Actually, the skin is generated from the deep inside. So in the same way, in Vedic culture, you progress by losing your last skin. You shake it off, or it gets rubbed off for you. And the stone, in this case, is the words of the spiritual master. He's the stone that's helping you to shake off your last skin. And in shaking off that last skin, you find that you don't die, but you go through a momentary discomfort in order to find something more wonderful. So I say this at funerals, not this particular story, too much snakiness in that story, but I usually, because we're usually getting, devotees are usually, you know, cremated and something that is built to look a little bit like a non-denominational church, but there's usually some stained glass windows, some secular stained glass windows. And I point to the windows and I say, my dear Vaishnavas, just look at these stained glass windows. In this assembly, we're all flooded with color, red and green and blue and purple. You can see the beautiful windows. But from the outside of this building, all you see is gray. You have to be inside in order to see the sun coming through and illuminating your faces. So in the same way, a person has to be inside the house of God in order to see God's design. If you're outside the house of God, you just see black, gray. You can't see what's happening. I'm a great fan of Padre Pio. Saint Padre Pio, no? He used to tell the story, let it go over your heads. He was a saint in Italy, Catholic saint. Anyway, he used to tell the story of a mother that was making the embroidery. The child, when she's at her mother's knee, looks up and make embroidery. You have a hoop or a square, and you're putting the different colors through. But you may not use all the colors at the same time. So, when the child is looking up and seeing her mother, she sees the underside of the embroidery hoop, and there's no design. There's nothing. She can't see anything. All she can see is loose threads hanging. No design at all. It's only from the mother's point of view that you can see that there is a design. And the design is very slowly becoming manifest. So in our lives, sometimes we don't see the plan. We don't see the design. But there is a design. But when we look up, you know, we look up to the face of God and we say, why? Why? What plan do you have for me? I can't see any plan at all. I see one thread over here. I see a loose thread of another color over here. Another one there and another one there. If you're God, if you're Krishna, you must be so well organized that you have a plan for me. And if you don't have a plan for me that's personal, then how are you a personal God? Because I really need to feel that God is personal, because that's what we say. Krishna is a supreme person who can relate to every single living entity in an individual way. So surely, Krishna must reveal his plan for me soon. But sometimes we look up in our childish innocence and we don't see that plan. But Krishna is very carefully putting all the threads together. At the right time, we see the plan. Third story, when the child is in the womb, child is in the womb for 9 months. Your mothers know what I'm talking about. The child's in the womb for 9 months. Sometimes a little bit longer, sometimes a little bit less, but around about 9 months. And the child in the womb has all the food, all the oxygen, all the temperature, you see. There's some discomfort, but at least it's, you know, it's a space in which the child is protected. However, the child then hears a voice. My dear son, my dear daughter, it's time for you to be born. It's time for you to come into this world and accept your destiny. This is the voice of God. So the child is born, but the child doesn't want to come out. I don't want to come out. I'm comfortable in here. But then when the child is born, he or she sees, oh, this is much better than the womb. Much better than that dark place. Much better. This is, I can see the face of my mother. How wonderful. I can see the face of my father. Goo, goo, ga, ga, ga. I can have milk. Hooray. That's better than just placental fluid. Yes. And now I can sing, I can dance, I can run, I can play. So similarly, towards the end of our life, again, there's the voice of God. My son, my daughter, it's time for you to come. I don't want to go. I don't want to go. I want to stay here. I can run. I can skip. I can jump. I can dance. I can be young forever. And the voice of God says, I'm sorry. That's not my plan. Just as it was not my plan for you in the womb, it's not my plan for you in the womb of the material world. You have to come out. And your time has come. So before that time comes, the voice of God through the Vedas and through the walking Veda, the Guru, says, get ready because the time is coming. No. No. I'm a Prabhupada disciple. Surely you should give me a long life. No, I'm sorry. I look at your history here. I see that no, there's nothing I can do, I'm afraid. Your life is not that long. But I'm a GBC member. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't see anything in here. But I'm married. I have children. Well, yes, so does everybody else. So does everybody else. I'm afraid your material body is material. You're a devotee, but it's the soul that's a devotee, not your material body. But you said you would protect me. You said you would protect me. You know, you're the person who protected Gajendra. You're the person who protected Prahlad. You're the person who protected Draupadi. Why don't you protect me? This is my protection. This is my protection. There's something far better I want for you. And then we have to accept our destiny. So, we cannot postpone the inevitable. The inevitable is coming. So to make it easy on us, there's these different stages. And as we talked about yesterday, each stage has a different purpose. Brahmacharya ashram, to prepare you for the long journey of life. You must study the Vedas. Because at that age, that's when your memory is at its sharpest. You see? Don't try to read Prabhupada's books when you're my age. Because you read Prabhupada's books and you'll close them and that's it. What did I just read? Oh, I don't know. I don't know, it was nice, but I forget. And when you're young, I learned a verse in 1976. It was a verse that we would chant before we went downstairs. This was in our temple. They prepared the very first translation of the Satkriya Saradipika, a little section of the Hari Bhakti Vilas. It was ISKCON's very first puja handbook. You know, it was the white cover, ring-bound, waterproof. All the pages were made of plastic. And it was a great achievement. Prabhupada wanted a book, a puja handbook, for all the pujaris all over the movement. And it was to be 20 pages long, Prabhupada said. Well, we delivered a book to him that was more than 64 pages. There were so many nice things they didn't want to leave out. Anyway, Prabhupada was happy that it, finally his devotees were coming up towards what he said was the standard, Radharaman. He said, see how Radharaman does it. Just the other day we saw the final funeral ceremonies of Her Grace Mother Yamuna on the banks of the Yamuna and in the waters of the Yamuna. And Prabhupada had sent her to the Radharaman temple to see how they worship. He said, this is very high standard. So she came back with notebooks filled with outfits and shringar and different alankaram and different procedures and different recipes. She got the recipes and she wrote them all down. It was never published. Never published. Now they're working on it. Anyway. Where was I? Oh, the puja book. Yes, the puja book. Anyway, that verse. So, 25. So that was 1976, was how many years ago? How many years ago? Huh? Is it 36 years ago? Okay, 36 years ago, 36 years ago was the last time I chanted that verse as a brahmachari. Okay? And I saw it once the other day. And it goes like this. Jayati jananivaso devaki janmavado yadu varaparishat swayir dorbir asyanna dharman stira charina susmita shimokena. Susmita shimokena. How does it go? Vraja pura vanitanam varadayan kamadevam. So, that is 36 years later, and I have not chanted that verse for 36 years. I'm not trying to show you how great a pundit I am, because I haven't chanted a verse for 36 years, so how great a pundit is that? But the fact is, when you learn these shlokas in your youth, they will come back to you in your old age. So those of you who are young should learn verses. Those of you who are young should learn while you can. And that's what Radhadesh, I think, is about. Seems to be about all these young people here, learning, learning, learning. It's very important. So these things you will carry with you. Then, Grihastha life is when you forget all your verses. Because you're too busy, you know. I can be reading Prabhupada's books, and then the next moment, I have to, you know, pull up the legs and wipe the bottom. And take the dirty diaper, the dirty nappy out. That was some years ago. Okay? Or you have to sit and deal with teenage children, teenage angst. Or you'd have to do shopping. Yes, you brahmachari, you should, back to Rimi, you should shake your head. Yes. And as every brahmachari has done in the history of ISKCON, they will say, oh, I will never get married. That was everybody else. But you, you will never get married. So that is Grihastha life. And believe me, Grihastha life lasts a long time. Therefore, Chanakya Pandit, he gives some good advice. Chanakya Pandit actually wasn't a great Grihastha example. So sometimes when we see things that were spoken or written by Chanakya Pandit, you know, we have to take it with a tiny little pinch of salt and a little bit of Belgian mayonnaise. His married life was somewhat difficult. Chanakya. He couldn't get married. You know the story? No, he couldn't get married. His complexion was... he was a Brahmin, but his complexion was dark. And in those days, people liked to have the shukal. Shukal varna. They used to like to have very light-complexioned Brahmanas. For the wives, for Brahmana daughters. So he found himself jobless, and he found himself wifeless. And of course the job comes before the wife. That is what Prabhupada said. One devotee came to him one time, and he said, Prabhupada, I would like to be married. Prabhupada said, get a job. You have job, and no wife. The devotee was shocked. Prabhupada, I'm a devotee. Yes, get a job. Why? Because you will need to support wife. That's the main thing. Because Maya makes you think of the pretty face of your wife and all the wonderful times that you'll have skipping, running, jumping together down the heavenly fields of whatever field is near your home. But really, the reality is money. Wealth, dunam. Not dunam, but dunam. So you must create wealth. So Grihastha life is all about wealth creation. Brahmachari life is just waiting for someone to feed you. And so Grihastha life is beset with responsibilities. If you the Vedic culture is sex life only for children. And sometime, you know, it was one time, Narayan Maharaj, he said, I don't know where your Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj got that from. Well, Narayan Maharaj, I tell you where it's from. It's from the 11th canto. It's actually from the 11th canto where Krishna is speaking to Uddhava, his final instructions on how to practice consciousness of him in the ensuing years. So it is there. But if you haven't read as far as the 11th canto, then you might have missed it. That's the bad news. Okay? The bad news is that if you do it properly, you will have about 11 children, which is the Vedic blessing when you get married. Okay? may she have 11 children. Bhaktivinoda Thakur did it properly. You see. And he had many children. But he had a good job as well, so he was able to pay for them all. The difficulty for ISKCON is that none of us seem to have many children. And this is a big problem, demographically, for ISKCON. Because while ISKCON has been very, very busy distributing books and encouraging people in their spiritual life, the grihasthas have not been having enough children. And meanwhile, there are other members of other faiths who see it as their journey, as their duty to propagate the world. My daughter, Tulsi, who's a midwife, she told me the other day she had successfully delivered one lady's 12th child. Child number 12. And I said, was it easy? She said, yeah, it was easy. She said, it gets easier. 12 children. Start young, and then 12 children. Gosh, I feel like Mother Ermila today. It must be the lingering presence of Mother Ermila here at Radhadash. I'm no living example of this, and it's hard to find a living example of this, because if you join, as we said, if we come to Krishna consciousness, normally the average age for a devotee coming to Krishna consciousness is sort of mid-20s. If you come in the mid-20s, say goodbye to your career, normally. And say goodbye. One devotee came to me, one young grihastha came to me the other day. He said, you know what, Kripamoy, I've come to a conclusion. ISKCON is career suicide. I said, yes, to a certain extent it is. Because the years when you're meant to be learning, this is how the Buddhists did it. They had a university, Krishna Kshetra was telling us the other day, that a university in northern India, 20,000 students. 20,000 students. The buildings for those students to hold the students were 7 stories high. And this is in India 2,000 years ago. 20,000 students, 7-story buildings, and the students in the morning would learn, not the Vedas of course, but the Buddhist textbooks, but in the afternoon they would learn their career. And they got their career in the afternoon, then they said goodbye to their Buddhist gurus, then they went home. And then they did their successful career because they're well trained in architecture or mathematics or accounting or whatever it was. So that's part of how Buddhism flourished. That's how a culture flourishes. You get the young people and you train them how to be successful, but also how to be spiritual. I would say that that's possibly the next stage for our movement, so that we can have successful grihasthas instead of grihasthas who struggle. Do we struggle? Well, I think spiritually our grihastha ashram is somewhat strong, but as Chanakya Pandit said, I'll finish the story, shall I? Well, he was walking along one day, and you know kusha grass that you use for ceremonies and everything, it's very sharp. The ends of it are very sharp, especially when it's growing in the ground. So he stepped on some kusha grass and he was bleeding. And so he bandaged his foot, and then he went to the king of that particular region to try to get a job as a court minister, as a Brahmin. He was very well educated, Chanakya Pandit, but so far no job. Brahmins have to travel, because all the stories in the Vedas start. Once upon a time, there was a poor Brahmin. Right? Have you ever heard a story? Once upon a time, there was a Brahmin who was doing quite well. He didn't really have any material desires. He didn't have any material needs. No, you don't read those stories. It's always, once upon a time, there was a poor Brahmin. Because in that story somewhere is how that poor Brahmin became encouraged by something that happened. But it always involves the Brahmin leaving home to find someone who will need his skills. So he went to the king. They saw his bandaged foot, and he told them the story or something like that. So then they wanted to know, is this Brahmin, what sort of person is he? So they followed him, and one of the other ministers hid behind a tree. And then they saw that he went right back to the place where the kusha grass had stabbed him in the foot. And he was pouring cow's milk on the kusha grass. Now, if you pour cow's milk on kusha grass, it not only rots it, but it kills the plant. So the minister hiding behind the tree, he saw that and he saw this Brahmin. He's not only a Brahmin, but he's got a Kshatriya edge to him. The kusha grass was his enemy. And even though it was only kusha grass, he wanted to kill the enemy using his knowledge. This is the one that we want. So Chanakya Pandit was hired by, Chandragupta. And he became the Chanakya Pandit that's so famous that even today, I'm sitting here in Belgium talking about him thousands of years later. He became very famous. I think he also probably got a wife too. But it was up to that point, it was very hard for him. So he said that a woman's faith in her husband is tested in the time of financial adversity. Meaning that the relationship between husband and wife, if there's no money, is very difficult. Very, very difficult. You know, it's not glorious to be a poor householder. It's just as inglorious as it is to be a rich brahmachari or a rich sannyasi. You're not meant to be a rich sannyasi or a rich brahmachari, but you're meant to be at least well supported as a householder. You know, it goes with it. The clue is in the word. Householder. You hold a house. How much is the average Belgian house worth? That's how much, at least that's much how much you should have. If householders become overly dependent on the charity of others, then it's not good for the psychology of the householder. But we do what we can do. All of us have been asked by Srila Prabhupada, who came alone, without much money, hardly any money at all, to start the Krishna Consciousness Movement. So the first few decades of the Krishna Consciousness Movement, it is what it is. But then at a certain point we have to look at our scriptures and see, let's try to make ISKCON what it should be. Let's try to make it something, because now less and less people are living in our temples. Okay, but in England I know about 90% of our householders have never ever lived in a temple and never will. But so they need those who do live in temples and who do study Prabhupada's books more than them to tell them how to live a prosperous and successful grihastha ashram. I was speaking yesterday to the students about the importance of Vaishnava ceremonies for householders, how each stage in our life is accompanied by a Vedic samskar, how we can celebrate the devotee's transition so that it's less painful. Less, you know, the skin is there. You're going to lose something, but you're going to gain something. You see? Going from brahmachari life, let me tell you, going from brahmachari life to householder life, for me, was so painful. I tell my wife, I was in my head a brahmachari for years after I got married. Because there was no one around to tell me, this is how a householder thinks. This is how a householder behaves. This is how a householder makes money, spends money. I was just making money and giving it all to the temple. Now that's right, it put a smile on the temple president's face. But then when the temple president left with the money, I thought, yes. When the temple president went away with the money, I thought, did I do the right thing? Did I do the right thing? Was there some better way that I could have arranged my life? And now, when I'm over 50, when perhaps, you know, I need money for different things, then it becomes a little difficult. So, all the verses and all the Vedic education, do it now. For you grihasthas, the money making, do it now. You see, there's no day more important than today. But we do it in a balanced way. And when we make these transitions in our life, all the devotee community should be there to support us. It's very important. So if you want to be an independent householder, you should also consider what that means and whether you will lose the spiritual support, the emotional support of a devotee community that you've got. So that you cannot pay for because you cannot buy. I'm just balancing that statement. Because if Krishna consciousness is your goal, then living together with other people who want to be Krishna conscious, you can't even pay for that kind of company. But if you are living together with other devotees, for God's sake, make the most of them. Make the most of them. Because when you live together with other devotees, as you do here at Radhadesh, they're all precious jewels. So if Krishna has given you all these precious jewels, look at each and every devotee as a precious jewel. And what can you find from them? Every jewel has a radiance. So what does it mean to get the radiance of a particular jewel? Because each jewel is reflecting to you an aspect of Krishna's power, Krishna's majesty, Krishna's kindness, Krishna's love, Krishna's knowledge, Krishna's potency. So how can I bathe in that reflection from that devotee? That devotee is only here because he or she has realized something of Krishna. Otherwise, why would you live here? You'd go and live in a big city, or you'd live in a place where you can run, skip and jump with your wife in a field filled with flowers. Okay? As Prabhupada says here. But the fact that we're here means that we want something more than that. So therefore, we have to make the best use of the situation. So, my dear Prabhu, what is the best thing that you've learned in Krishna consciousness? This is a very good question for devotees. Not what time is prasadam. Okay. Who's giving class today? Or, where can I borrow a car? Or, are you going shopping? Can you get me something? Or, do you know where the photocopier is? Okay, these are all interesting questions. But the most interesting question is, my dear Prabhu, can you please tell me what aspect of Krishna most impresses you? Can you please tell me how you came to Krishna consciousness? How did you feel when you came to Krishna? Can you please tell me, you who are blessed with many years, can you please tell me why you've stayed in Krishna consciousness all this time? Can you please tell me how you've coped with all the difficulties that you must have been through in your many transitions over the years? Can you please tell me what service you do and how it makes you feel when you serve Krishna in that way? These are Vaishnava questions. And I think it's Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur that says, when one Vaishnav meets another Vaishnav, after paying obeisances, he says, my dear Prabhu, can you please tell me how you serve your Lord? How do you serve Him? Please tell. Actually, what he says, when one sadhu meets another sadhu, they usually carry their thakur in a bag, in a cloth bag around their neck. And one sadhu is meant to say to the other sadhu, my dear Prabhu, can you please tell me, who is that around your neck? Which Lord are you carrying? Which Lord are you the servant of? How do you serve Him? What do you do for Him each day? How does that make you feel? And then they will sit and they'll discuss about Krishna and exchange all those verses that they learned as brahmacharis. You see? So that's just a few things about that stage of life. And then we come to a stage which seems to be the stage of loss. And I don't know exactly how this is going to happen in ISKCON. Prabhupada writes about it because Prabhupada is the founder. He's the founder Acharya. When was Prabhupada when he took sannyas? How old was he? He was how old? He took sannyas in 1959. So he was 63. So Prabhupada was 63 when he took sannyas. And he'd been living away from his family for a few years before that, correct? Yeah. So the point here is that, give or take a few years, Prabhupada seems to be, well, not seems to be, he is insisting that 50 is the marker. That 50 is the marker. And we may not be able to take sannyas. Although, Prabhupada said when he had the dream of his Guru Maharaj telling him to take sannyas, he said, I was horrified. I was horrified. But didn't he have the dream twice? It was a horrible dream for him. He thought, how can I do that? It's a horrible dream. You see, he'd cared for his wife for 40 years. This is interesting. The Prabhupada that we think we know, this Prabhupada, is the Prabhupada of 70 years old onwards. But the Prabhupada we don't know is the householder that looked after his wife for how many years? 40 years. The responsible householder, who, even though she was at times reportedly not so easy to support him in his Vaishnava practices, still he was a dutiful husband. That's the Prabhupada we don't hear of. If Prabhupada had come to America and he'd been a householder, then I think our movement would be a bit different. Maybe all the GBC would be householders. What do you think, Rina? If Prabhupada had come and he was one of four people to come to America, sent, you know, and then we would be more interested in teams. As it is, our movement is shaped around the character of rugged individual sannyasis. That's sort of the highest aspiration for a lot of us. Because that's how we saw Prabhupada, that's how Krishna gave us his personality. So many things could have happened, but it happened in the way that it happened. Prabhupada, as a sannyasi, we can see that he's showing us a type of life which is not actually a Srimad Bhagavatam sannyasi that we find in these sections, and certainly not in the 11th section. The reason, for instance, why this color, this orange color, is there, because it frightens away tigers. They don't like it. It frightens away creatures. And sannyasis behave in a certain way. We have many codes for sannyas life that are there from ancient times. But in Prabhupada's life, we see that some of them were dispensed with. So he adopted the rules of sannyas and kept the basic principles of sannyas. So this is what he's giving us. But here, in these sections, he's saying at age 50, then it's time for this big transition to go, to carry on. Well, how is that? How shall I do that? Well, we don't have, in our movement, we don't have a particular way of doing it, but there are different suggestions. By the time we get to the 11th canto, we see what the suggestions are. We read that there are four ashrams, and we also see that within those four ashrams, there are four divisions. Each of them has four divisions, and each of them is progressive. So it's not an abrupt jump, but within each ashram there's four divisions. And it's a gradual leaving go of attachments by cultivating detachment. It's something that has to be cultivated. Now, if you're a materialistic husband and wife, you've not cultivated any detachment, you've cultivated only attachment over the years. They become more and more attached. One day I was at Radhakund. We was on the Brajmandal Parikrama, which is a good way actually to cultivate detachment from, you know, everything. Your shoes, your bed, your wife, you know, your money, everything. But I will say one thing actually, that if you want to practice Vanaprastha, a good way to do it is, you know, Chanakya Pandit says 2 months away from your wife each year is a good way for a man to practice detachment. And the man goes traveling for 2 months a year. So, I was at Radhakund, and this man had just died. Imagine this. A man dies at 9 o'clock in the morning. And as we were walking by, his body was being taken out of the... His body had just been taken out of the house an hour ago. We came by at 10 o'clock. And at 10 o'clock, his wife died. 10 o'clock, his wife died. Unbearable. She could not bear the separation from her husband. That is the degree of attachment that takes place in family life. Now, as householders in the Krishna consciousness movement, Prabhupada has given us a great gift that we have been guided towards not developing too many attachments, but to cultivating detachment, you know, and in different ways. If you could see we can only compare ourselves with each other. But sometimes when we bring people from who are not devotees and they see the way our husbands and wives live, they say they're quite astonished. They usually say things like, "But don't you love each other?" Yes, we love each other. Householders in ISKCON do love each other, but we live like this. But how do you express your love? You know, he's sleeping over there, you're sleeping over there. Don't you love each other? Or, you know, she dresses in the same dress every day. You know, she's got five saris. Do you not love your husband to dress nicely? Yes, but this is how we... And so there's another ethos there. And it's all about controlling the mind. Controlling the mind and not putting down too many deep roots, the deep roots of attachment. And how is that done? Well, by cultivating Krishna consciousness right through Grihastha life, and, this is the best way, staying with the same person all the way through life, so that the beautiful young girl you married in that Vedic fire yajna, gradually, you look at her every day as a husband, and she's gradually changing into an old woman. And then you look and you realize, actually, life has passed us by. And she, of course, she looks at you and she thinks, that's not the person I married. So gradually, physically, you change appearances. And then vanaprastha cultivates that even more. Now, traditional vanaprastha is where the wife no longer combs her hair. She doesn't color her hair. She doesn't comb her hair. She doesn't cut her hair. Imagine that, ladies. What you'd look like, eh? She doesn't wear bangles. She wears the same cloth every day. She doesn't cut her nails. She doesn't even brush her teeth. Yeah. Husbands, you want to practice detachment? That's the way to do it. Meanwhile, let's hear what the husbands look like. So every aspect of attraction in the husband is also there. He also doesn't cut his hair or his beard, okay? Doesn't cut his nails. He dresses in the skin of animals that he's found, dead animals that he's found along the way. Think of it this way, ladies, you get a fur coat. And he dresses in, or tree bark, they dress in tree bark, and they just eat not cooked food, but sometimes they can have cooked roots, bulbs, fruits, like that. If you can't do that, there's another way. Okay, there's another way of doing it. You have to look the same, but it's called sankalpa. Sankalpa means when you go to seven houses, whichever way your face is looking when you wake up in the morning. So whichever way your face is, because you're in a different... Don't forget, vanaprastha means you're traveling with your wife. Okay, Rudai? You're traveling with your wife. And you're traveling with your wife. And wherever you sleep for that night, under which tree you sleep, then when you wake up in the morning, whichever way your face is pointing, east, south, north, west, in that direction you walk, and when you walk, when you're hungry, the first seven houses that you beg at, whatever they give you, that's your food for the day. You're not allowed to go to the eighth house, but those first seven houses was there. Now, I did that once on Brajmandal Parikrama. Not exactly that, but pretty much. On Brajmandal Parikrama, you have to walk 128 miles, which is quite a few kilometers, all around Braj, and you see the different parts of Krishna's pastimes, etc. But we used to get brought breakfast by the ISKCON vehicles that would come out. However, many times they just didn't make it in what could reasonably be called breakfast time. 11:30 for me is not breakfast. 12 o'clock is not breakfast. It's too late. And I was a younger man then. It was 1986. In fact, I was the first Englishman to do this Brajmandal program. So my feet were hurting, my stomach was hurting, and I was thinking, oh, why? And then one devotee said, just beg. He said, just go, just knock on the door of a house. This is Braj. This is Krishna's backyard. This is the place where Krishna actually walked. Do you think that Radharani will let you go hungry? You've come all the way from England to walk in Krishna's pastures. Do you think that Radharani will let you go hungry? I hadn't thought of that. I hadn't quite thought of that, you know, divine connection. I thought that somehow Krishna wanted me to be hungry. And that's why I hadn't had any food. Well, no. Krishna has a plan. Krishna has a plan for your stomach. And it's a divine plan. So here it is. Go to seven houses and beg. So I went to the first house. Of course, I'd say knock on the door, but you don't knock on the door. You have to say, Oma bhavati bhiksham dehe, which is what a brahmachari, this is the most important phrase for a brahmachari. So all the brahmacharis, please say, Oma bhavati bhiksham dehe, which means, oh mother, please give me some alms. Very important. Anywhere you go in India, if you're dressed in this color, you can go to any door and you can say, and you have to put on that expression, Oma bhavati bhiksham dehe. And any mother, any wife, their hearts will melt. Their hearts will melt. And they will come and they will give something. So in Braj I was getting stacks of chapatis and sabji and buttermilk. And it actually works. And gur, purana gur, old, mature, you know, date sugar. And it actually works. And it's very tasty. And I carried on my way. Thank you, Krishna. Thank you, Radha. So every day that was my... In fact, I got to the point where I had to cut down because I was eating too much. Big Brahmin belly. How are you getting fat on Braj Mandal Prakram? Aha. I have a kind God. So do not think that Krishna wants us to suffer. In the middle of the suffering, there's another plan. There's another purpose. If you cannot do that, Krishna says in the 11th canto, and aren't you glad that we're telling you these things? Krishna says, then you just do something else which is called pratipradika, and you find... you find people to support you. You find a few people who will pay for you as a sadhu. You see? They don't all have to be in Dubai, let me tell you this. You don't have to emulate other swamis who go to Dubai. Dubai is very good for penniless swamis. Have you ever met a penniless ISKCON swami? No, I haven't either. So you see? They gave their lives to Krishna, and Krishna filled their hands with so much they just can't deal with it all. But the GBC will deal with it very soon. That's an inside joke, and I'm looking at Riddhi. So, this spirit is that from wherever we are, we see what's the next step forward for me. And if you don't know what the next step forward for you is, you can always ask a friend. That's what friends are for. The next step forward may be to get married. The next step forward may be to take Vanaprasa. The next step forward may be to, you know, have that baby that you've put off because you're really worried about being a mother. You're okay, you're just about okay being a wife, but you're really worried about being a mother. So the next step for you may be to have that baby. So we abandon fear and we take the next step in our transition. And really that's what the guru is for. The guru is meant to give you advice that will last you all your life, taking into consideration your age, your ashram, your faith, your particular circumstances. That's what the guru does, you see. And then you get on, and then you can go and see the guru in a little bit later. So wise advice, wise counsel. So then sannyas, the reason why brahmachari life is different from sannyas is brahmachari life has the option of marriage and sannyas life does not. As I said yesterday, I was meeting with one brahmachari and he was trying to tell me that brahmachari life was the renounced ashram. No, you haven't, because you haven't renounced the option of grihastha life. You see? And that is a very powerful renunciation. when you do that finally, and you actually mean it, and you burn that those grains in the fire, Prabhupada says you become dead to the world. You're dead before you're dead. You become civilly dead. When I was very young, 17, I saw the papers of one sannyasi, his name was Rebati Nandan Swami, and written across it in big felt pen, someone had written, civilly dead. Whether they'd written it as a joke or something, but civilly dead. He was a civilly dead man. He was dead to the world, no identity. So it is a very grave commitment. So sannyasis should not be encouraged to take part in anything which may jeopardize their ashram. Brahmacharis should not be spoken to in any way which will jeopardize their studies. Householders should not be tempted to become poor, because the story of Sudama... Sorry, I'm going over a little bit. I'll finish here. The story of Sudama, the Brahmin, everybody knows it, but it has two purports. One purport is that if you're poor and you worship Krishna in Dasirasa as a friend, then Krishna will give you, you know, very nice things. But actually it's that Sudama's poverty is what purchased Krishna's blessings. But our Vaishnava Acharyas say, no, that's not the case. Sudama was actually attached to poverty. That was his attachment. And he thought that poverty was sufficient to purchase Krishna. And Krishna smashed that attachment by giving him wealth. See, it's the other way around. Whatever you're attached to, if you're attached to one thing, and that's actually forming an obstacle in your spiritual life, Krishna will give you the thing that breaks your attachments. It may be that being unmarried is your attachment. Krishna can break that also. Here, here's a wife. It may be that being married is an attachment. Oh, Krishna, yes, this is next stage of life for you, my friend. It may be that... So in many different ways we have... You know, we have to move on, and Krishna will make that arrangement for us. My grandfather... used to be a cook. He was a cook in the army. And in the army, there was a person known as Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill was at one time the Prime Minister of England. But when he was a young man, he was a reporter. So he was taken prisoner with the officers, and my grandfather was taken prisoner with the ranks. Then they brought the cooks over to the officers' place to cook for the officers. You see, officers always, they have to eat well. So that was one thing you did. So they brought the cooks. So there was my grandfather cooking for the officers and Winston Churchill. Later on, my grandmother, because he didn't know who this person was going to be, but later on, my grandmother said to him, "You used to cook for Winston Churchill, now he's the Prime Minister." And they were extremely poor. They were very, very poor. And one Christmas, this is the time when a Christian householder is supposed to, at least at Christmas, you can provide for your family. They had nothing. So she said, "Why don't you go and see Winston Churchill, you know, at Downing Street? You can tell him that you were the cook when he was a young man." And, just a little bit like Sudama the Brahmin. Anyway, he didn't take that option. But what he did was he walked out of the house and he walked to the gate of his house and he got down on his knees and he prayed. And he prayed to God. He said, because he was a minister, he was a preacher by that time. And he said, "Dear God, I've given my life to you." He said, please make some arrangement for me. I trust you. The very same afternoon, people came, and they came with everything that he needed for, you know, a wonderful Christmas. So that proved to him not only that there was a God, but the fact that if you just did this, you just surrendered to God, that God would provide for your needs. So that story sort of comes down in the family. So occasionally I use that. Krishna. Krishna,
I've only got a few dhotis and a few kirtas, you know. But if you want me, you know, you want me here, then please make some arrangement for me. And it always seems to work, you see. Then I get a phone call from Yadunandan Swami and says, come to Radhadesh, we'll pay your train. Thank you, Krishna. I come to this very rich temple. Well, the Lord of the Gopis is always looking after his devotees. Hare Krishna. So, Shri Shri Radha Gopinath ki jai, Shri Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Maharani ki jai, Shri Shri Gornatai ki jai, all the Vaishnavas ki jai, Hare Krishna. For those of you who, you know, Krishna has provided breakfast, and those of you who want to ask questions, I think. Yeah. Then what most of us do in ISKCON, we do, you know, actually, if you're a Brahmin, I was talking to one Brahmin in South India. He said a Brahmin man, a Brahmin husband, he will get up at 2:30 in the morning, and he will not eat until 2:30 in the afternoon. He said, "This is Brahmin." I said, "People still live like that?" He said, "Yes." And all, what do they do? It's what every Brahmin does. Japa, swadhyay, study, you know. And then they do puja. And then they do teaching. They teach people. And then they have prasadam. 2:30 in the morning they get up. They may go to the temple, have darshan. But they do everything, and then 2:30 in the afternoon they eat. People still live like that. You go to South India. It's not all, you know, corrupt Brahmins opening the deities to, you know, collect some coins. There is Brahminical culture. You know, it still lives. And of course it still lives in ISKCON. We, you know, Bhagavatam class every single morning for this length of time. This is a very, very serious commitment that everybody makes, coming to Bhagavatam class. And coming to Mangalarti is an amazing thing. An amazing thing. So, every ashram has to study Shastra. Every ashram. But particularly brahmacharis. Brahmacharis study with a view to committing it to memory. This is the point. This is a special benediction for brahmacharis, that they study and they commit to memory. You're measured as a brahmachari not by how many books you distribute, but by how many books you remember. That's brahmachari life. How many books have you remembered? We have brahmacharis in our place who went to Vrindavan Gurukul. They can sit down and they can recite all of Bhagavad Gita, all the Sanskrit. Maybe they're patchy on one or two chapters, but they start, Dharmakshetri, Kurukshetri, and they finish, you know, they go all the way through. And we have people in brahmacharis in Chaupati who are still, you know, that brahmachari culture is there. When you're living in a place where 150 brahmacharis, that's good kirtan, good study. But then the point is that they have 4,500 householders who are helping to keep those 150 brahmacharis brahmachari. This is the whole point, that every householder should adopt a brahmachari as their child. We have an ashram near us, and it's a Buddhist ashram. But in the local area, these are just ordinary English people who are not Buddhists. Ordinary English people. And they have adopted a Buddhist monk. And the monks know that they can go to that house and they go, "Oh, come in, our monk has come." And sometimes they can be there for the weekend, you know. Rent a monk. Like Hertz, rent a car, you know. Rent a monk. And the monk, what does he do? He just, yes, he eats. You know, he gets to eat well. And he recites the Buddhist scriptures. And these are English men. Not men flown in from Sri Lanka and India or China. These are Buddhist men, these are English men who have become Buddhist monks in Saffron, being adopted by an English family who are not Buddhists sometime, but they become very, very favorable because they live very close to a Buddhist ashram. I am not recommending it to you brahmacharis to do immediately in Septon or in Dubui. Maybe it wouldn't go down too well. But I have done it many, many years ago as a brahmachari. Someone told me this is what we're supposed to do. So all day long we would distribute books. And then in the evening, hello, I'm a monk. You know, I'm a monk. I wondered. Okay, come the eyes. I wondered, could you spare a little bit of vegetarian food? And people, they look at you, they look up and down, and he's not asking for money. And any woman that comes to the door, and she sees, I was a young man then. Now they'd slam the door in my face and call the police. But I was a young man with a nice face and a shaven head and proper. And in those days, we all used to wear what we call sannyasi tops or yakis. In those days, that's how ISKCON brahmacharis used to dress. Everybody had sannyasi tops. Please. And they would all come out and we would hold our tops like this and people would give something. And actually, we had groceries, we had boga, for the whole week. It's amazing how generous people can be. It's something deep within them that they know that saintly people come and ask for food and no woman will refuse. If she's kind. There's a story once of a, and this is my last, there's a sadhu, a brahmachari, and he went to a door, this was in India, classical story, he goes to the door and he says, Uma, bhavati bhiksham dehi. And she says, bhiksham? You know, donations? Yes, okay, I'll get you something. So she goes in and she takes a handful of ash from the fire and she says, here, that's what I give you. And it went all over the top of the other food that he just collected. You see? She said, that's what I think of you. And what did he do? Did he get angry? No, he thanked her. He said, Ma, today you have reminded me that one day this body that you see before you will become ash like this. From ash it has come, from ash it will go. Thank you so much. And then he looked at her face and she began to cry and she said, no. She said, no, stop. She said, let me replace everything that I've spoiled. Here, throw that away. I will give you everything now. Thank you. Come in. So, to beg is one thing, to be grateful for the responses that you get, that's another. And that cultivates humility. So brahmachari cultivates these two things. Humility, because through humility and celibacy you can remember things and you can learn them, commit them to memory. You see? And become a better devotee of Krishna. Hare Krishna. Thank you. Hare Krishna.